I missed my cue, my bad. All right. Well, thank you guys for coming tonight. I will try to do my best not to keep you here forever. I know we get a long weekend, so I know people are anxious to do other things. I could do that, couldn't I? But I won't. So tonight we're going to be reading at Numbers 22. So if you guys will turn there. And we're mostly going to stay in the book of Numbers. I know sometimes, like when I speak, we kind of hop around a lot, and then it gets overwhelming or frustrating and kind of makes people question, what do these verses have anything to do with what he's talking about now? And I'm asking for a good reader who can read Numbers 22 for me. And notice Laura's quickly leaving. Deborah, would you mind reading Numbers 22 for us? I'll need you to do it on the mic, though, because we are recording. Thank you. She's awesome. No one volunteered you, by the way. Okay, so yeah, someone volunteered you. I was trying to help. So Numbers 22, we'll end. We're reading the whole thing. So yeah.
So the whole chapter?
Yes, ma'am.
That's why we're having someone else do it.
Then the Israelites traveled to the plains of Moab and camped along the Jordan across from Jericho. Now Balak, son of Zippor, saw all that Israel had done to the Amorites, and Moab was terrified because there were so many people. Indeed, Moab was filled with dread because of the Israelites. The Moabites said to the elders of Midian, "This horde is going to lick up everything around us, as an ox licks up the grass of the field." So Balak, son of Zippor, who was king of Moab at the time, sent messengers to summon Balaam, son of Beor, who was at Pethor near the river in his native land. Balak said, "A people has come out of Egypt. They cover the face of the land and have settled next to me. Now come and put a curse on these people, because they are too powerful for me. Perhaps then I will be able to defeat them and drive them out of the country, for I know that those you bless are blessed, and those you curse are cursed." The elders of Moab and Midian left, taking with them the fee for divination. When they came to Balaam, they told him what Balak had said. "Spend the night here," Balaam said to them, "and I will bring you back the answer the Lord gives me." So the Moabite princes stayed with him. God came to Balaam and asked, "Who are these men with you?" Balaam said to God, "Balak, son of Zippor, king of Moab, sent me this message. A people that has come out of Egypt covers the face of the land. Now come and put a curse on them for me. Perhaps then I will be able to fight them and drive them away." But God said to Balaam, "Do not go with them. You must not put a curse on those people because they are blessed." The next morning, Balaam got up and said to Balak's princes, "Go back to your own country, for the Lord has refused to let me go with you." So the Moabite princes returned to Balak and said, "Balaam refused to come with us." Then Balak sent other princes, more numerous and more distinguished than the first. They came to Balaam and said, "This is what Balak, son of Zippor, says. Do not let anything keep you from coming to me, because I will reward you handsomely and do whatever you say. Come and put a curse on these people for me." But Balaam answered them, "Even if Balak gave me his palace filled with silver and gold, I could do nothing great or small to go beyond the command of the Lord my God. Now stay here tonight, as the others did, and I will find out what else the Lord will tell me." That night God came to Balaam and said, "Since these men have come to summon you, go with them, but do only what I tell you." Balaam got up in the morning, saddled his donkey, and went with the princes of Moab. But God was very angry when he went, and the angel of the Lord stood in the road to oppose him. Balaam was riding on his donkey, and his two servants were with him. When the donkey saw the angel of the Lord standing in the road with a drawn sword in his hand, she turned off the road to get into a field. Balaam beat her to get her back on the road. Then the angel of the Lord stood in a narrow path between two vineyards with walls on both sides. When the donkey saw the angel of the Lord, she pressed close to the wall, crushing Balaam's foot against it. So he beat her again. Then the angel of the Lord moved on ahead and stood in a narrow place where there was no room to turn, neither to the right or to the left. When the donkey saw the angel of the Lord, she lay down under Balaam, and he was angry and beat her with his staff. Then the Lord opened the donkey's mouth, and she said to Balaam, "What have I done to make you beat me these three times?" Balaam answered the donkey, "You have made a fool of me. If I had a sword in my hand, I would kill you right now." Because that's what you say to a talking donkey.
Quiet, donkey.
The donkey said to Balaam, "Am I not your own donkey, which you have always ridden to this day? Have I been in the habit of doing this to you?" "No," he said. Then the Lord opened Balaam's eyes, and he saw the angel of the Lord standing in the road with his sword drawn. So he bowed low and fell face down and apologized to the donkey. No, he didn't. The angel of the Lord asked him, "Why have you beaten your donkey these three times? I have come here to oppose you because your path is a reckless one before me. The donkey saw me and turned away from me these three times. If she had not turned away, I would certainly have killed you by now, but I would have spared her." Balaam said to the angel of the Lord, "I have sinned. I did not realize you were standing in the road to oppose me. Now, if you are displeased, I will go back." The angel of the Lord said to Balaam, "Go with the men, but speak only what I tell you." So Balaam went with the princes of Balak. When Balak heard that Balaam was coming, he went out to meet him at the Moabite town on the Arnon border, at the edge of his territory. Balak said to Balaam, "Did I not send you an urgent summons? Why didn't you come to me? Am I really not able to reward you?" "Well, I have come to you now," Balaam replied, but can I say just anything? I must speak only what God puts in my mouth." Then Balaam went with Balak to Kirjath Huzoth. Balak sacrificed cattle and sheep and gave some to Balaam and the princes who were with him. The next morning, Balak took Balaam up to Bamoth-Baal, and from there he saw part of the people.
Can we get a round of applause? I didn't want to say any of those names of places and people. And I was just like, this is going to be terrible. So, and you did a much better job than I would have. I love the pauses and the... And unfortunately, thanks to the Shrek movies, like, this has totally taken on a different picture in my mind every time, like, I read the story. How many of you guys are reading this? I'm quick. One-handed. Yeah, it's cool. It happens. How many of you guys have heard that story for the first time tonight and maybe haven't heard it before? Don't be shy. I thought it was one of the most ridiculous stories I ever read when I first read my Bible. I'm like, you know, some of the things that Deborah highlighted, right? A talking donkey, and then a response to that donkey being perfectly normal, you know, just, sorry, I didn't see it, you know, like, as being, you know, the response. And I got to imagine, like, Balaam, in the future, sort of as this donkey has sort of, like, lived with him or, you know, was his property, that he would often probably talk to him after that. Like, I know you understand me. I know you hear what I'm saying. You know, I can't hear you anymore, but I know you heard me. You speak English, apparently, you know, so you understand it. So I really, yes, they were speaking English. America. Kind of un-American response is that? They weren't, the Bible wasn't written in English. Ridiculous. Ridiculous. We invented Christianity. What? No. No. I stand by my words. I stand by my words. You know what's really funny, though? We've had listeners that have actually listened to our podcast from Russia, because we could actually track, like, where people, like, listen to some of our stuff. And there are so many things that I thought, like, what isn't culturally relevant in other places that someone listening is like, what is a Chick-fil-A? Like, why are they so obsessed with it? Like, why do they keep talking about it? So, anyway, so I love the story. And to kind of color it a little bit, I'll just recap it real fast. You see the Moabites, or the people of Israel who have left Egypt, still haven't gotten to the Promised Land, and they're roaming around this area. And they're gaining a name for themselves. They're gaining a lot of notoriety. They fight the Ammonites who attack them, and they demolish them. And then when they're camped near the Moabites are now fearful of what might happen to them. And just to kind of paint a picture for you guys. The Ammonites and the Moabites are descendants of Moab and Ammon. Do you guys know who Moab and Ammon are? Does anybody here remember who these two people are? Deborah? They were Lot's two kids. Yeah, the two kids that he had with his two daughters, right? Out of this incestuous relationship that he had with his daughters, he has these two sons who later on create an entire tribe that opposed the tribe that he started with, right? In the story of Abraham and Lot, they separate. Abraham goes one way, right? And then from here on out, you just see Lot and his descendants produce two opposing forces that will attack the Israelites. And that enmity, I got to imagine, you know, runs deep, right? I mean, could you imagine if what it would have felt like for Lot and Abraham, who at one point had a very strong relationship, and Abraham repeatedly showed his loyalty to Lot despite several circumstances that Lot put himself in, if they both knew that years from now, your kids and their descendants, your great-grandkids, are going to attack mine. And we will oppose each other. And so here you have the Moabites fearful and concerned about what's going to happen. So they get this sorcerer named Balaam. They ask him to come and help them curse Israel because they know that by the accounts of what people are hearing about what Israel's capable of, everyone's hearing it as their strength is directly correlated to their faith in God. So they see it not as just a physical military might. They're recognizing there's some sort of faith journey that's kind of happening here. There's some kind of blessing that these guys have. And repeatedly over and over, as they read the Bible, the Moabites, the Ammonites, even the Egyptians, when the Egyptians got sacked by the Israelites, they sent word out that by the strength of their God, the whole plague thing, they sent word out, their God attacked us, and they, you know, ransacked us. And so that word went out that the God of Israel is a mighty one and will wreck your face. And so, true, written in English, those are the words that are in there. It's a difficult Hebrew word to pronounce, so I won't say it. It just means he who wrecks face. Jehovah wrecketh. So anyway, true fact. I went to Bible college, people, all right? So I got a degree. I know what I'm talking about. So he who has a bigger degree can argue now. So it really becomes not only a religious conflict, but there's a recognition that there has to be a two-front approach in taking out the Israelites, right? The Moabites are learning from the Ammonites' failure. They're like, the Ammonites faced these guys head on and lost, and they outnumbered them. So they're going, maybe we'll take the religious approach and we'll curse this guy. So they get Balaam involved. Balaam asks God. God says, don't do it. Don't you talk to them. You know, don't you get involved. He says, hey, I can't get involved. They come back and say, we will give you all this stuff. And he's like, I don't think you understand. I'm not going. And he goes, but I'll ask God again. God's like, okay, you can go. You can go. But clear, let me be clear, you don't say anything I don't tell you to say. So Balaam's like, all right, we're good. So Balaam leaves. And what I love about God's response is he let Balaam go, but he wanted to make it very clear to him exactly who he was representing and what the expectations were, right? Because he gives him the permission, but I got to imagine God's like, I need to remind this fool. I'm going to have to remind this fool exactly who he's talking to. And so you see this story where God performs three miracles, right? So the first one is the donkey talks. The second one is all of a sudden Balaam's eyes are open to this angel that is now on the road. And the third miracle is that he's spared. And he says it to him. He's like, I didn't take you out. He's like, your donkey. He's like, he made sure you were okay, but I could have, you know. And he made it very clear. Here's my expectation. He repeats himself a third time. Only say what I tell you to say because I'm blessing these people. I'm blessing them. And that is repeatedly Balaam's message to the messenger. They are blessed. They are blessed. I can't speak a word against them. They are blessed. It's a recognition of something that has already happened in a state that they already operate in. None of the arguments are, they will one day do this, they will one day do that. They're like, no, they're a blessed people. I can't speak against them. So the story continues, of course, and he makes it to where he's going, and the dude complains, you know, why didn't you come sooner? I appreciate Balaam not going, I had some traveling problems. My vehicle was not working at a certain point.
But I'm here. Let's just get this done. And as chapter 23 through 24 progresses, and I'll just read a couple highlights from there, you see in chapter 23 and 24, Balaam says, stands before Israel and sees Israel, and sees he stands in this valley where they're camped, and the Moabite king takes them there, and he sees them, and he can't curse them. He blesses them. He's like, I'm only going to bless them because that's what God tells me to. So the king Moab thinks, okay, maybe if you don't look at them, you know, so we'll just kind of back up, look at the edge of the camp and try again. And he's like, I'm not going to curse them. So he blesses them, right? And then in chapter 24, the wording is very interesting. After twice doing this, it says, now when Balaam saw that it pleased the Lord to bless Israel, so twice he had blessed them instead of cursing them, when Balaam saw that it pleased the Lord to bless Israel, he did not resort to sorcery as at other times. So meaning previously he was performing sorcery and he was blessing them, recognizing something. But then the third time it says, he did not resort to sorcery as at other times, but turned his face towards the desert. When Balaam looked out and saw Israel encamped tribe by tribe, the Spirit of God came upon him and he uttered his oracle. So it says, now God shows up, and he's like, we're just going to make sure this runs the way it's supposed to. And this oracle comes out, and he speaks through Balaam, and then, it's not even just like as previously where it was like a blessing, but it comes with like warnings. It's like, I'm going to bless them, I'm going to do this, and then to Moab, or the Balak, the king of the Moabites, telling him, and this will happen to you if you stand in their way. So a very severe warning comes in. And that's how the chapter ends, right? So what Numbers doesn't clarify, right? You've got this arching picture, but later on in Numbers 31 and in Revelation, it says that what happens next was actually due to Balaam's influence. So while Balaam initially has Israel's back or is blessing Israel and is doing what God's telling him to, as time goes by and he's recognizing that all the promises that the Moabite king has offered him, he says, I can't curse them, but I can tell you how you can usurp them. And you see it happen in Numbers 25. It says, when Israel was staying at Shittim, it's in there. This is why Deborah was up here reading. Staying in Shittim, the men began to indulge in sexual morality with the Moabite women, who invited them to sacrifices to their gods. The people ate and bowed down before these gods, so Israel joined in worshiping the Baal of Peor, and the Lord's anger burned against them. So Balaam suggested to the king of Moab, he says, if you send your women, and your women entice the men into ritual prostitution, and to serve your god, and created a religious issue where they're willfully making that decision, God will take his hands off, or they will walk away from the blessing that God has set. Right? So by enticing them to go after something that they perceive they don't have, or something that they desire, or something, by getting them to walk away from the reality that they possess and have something that is critical to their success, they can undermine the entire process of Israel being able to succeed and to grow. And so the king of Moab, or the Moabites, decides, that's the plan. Let's go with it. He says, I don't have to actually involve my forces. I can get these guys to, you know, hang themselves on their own actions and their own decisions. For tonight's purposes, if we look at the story and we see King Balaam, King Balak, being representative of the devil, being a picture of the devil seeking to sabotage a community like ours or the church, right? Looking at ways of how do I undo what has already occurred in the success that these people have, right? How do I, and when we consider sometimes even the challenges that most Christians feel that they have in our culture or even abroad in different communities, whether they're Christians living in North Korea or in China where Christianity is illegal, there's a recognition that there is a an attack, or there is an undermining process. There is something out there that wants to remove us from the blessings and callings that we operate under. And that force that exists acknowledges and recognizes that that can't be done through brute strength, but getting us to forget the blessings and callings that we're operating under and removing ourselves from underneath that blessing. If you look at the situation, I think Balaam really represents so easily a picture of ambassadors of God who have the power to curse or bless, right? Christians who have the power to bless or curse, you know, what's in front of them, right? And the role that we can play in undermining our own growth and our own success. In a circumstance where you're provoked, right? Someone who's provoking you in an argument, right? We all get into fights, arguments with spouses, friends, you know, whatever. In this political atmosphere that we live in, or whether it has to do with a football player not standing for the flag or an Olympic athlete lying about something somewhere, whatever the case might be, right? There's always something to provoke us into an action. And there's always an opportunity to come from underneath that blessing and that calling that's on us, right? And how often are we taught when we're, you know, be patient, don't give in to anger, don't be easily provoked, right? Don't be easily provoked. I, sadly enough, get a kick sometimes out of provoking my friends. I will say that. Like, I have a terrible reputation for being that guy that's just like, hey, what's wrong? So, you know, just, and I don't know why. It's just a bad childhood, I don't know, something. There's just Dawn, maybe, like hanging out with Dawn, yeah, for sure. Just, I get a kick sometimes out of seeing how people are easily provoked, right? And I hate it when it happens to me. When I know someone, I mean, dude, and I can't tell you, I've seen people, because they don't understand the platform that I have, and they think, they take it lightly, that will try to poke fun or provoke me into an argument or challenge something that I said or did or something I was involved in. I remember one time I was working with a particular denomination and I was working with a pastor and I had posted about it, and then someone just went off on me on why I would work with that person. And I remember my first reaction was, you don't know who you're talking to. Like, and I just started, getting angry and responding and like getting aggressive. I'm like, no. You are not going to make me look like a fool, like, because you don't acknowledge or recognize what I have. It's easy for you to talk like that. I can't, right? Right? When we recognize the responsibilities that we have at work or in whatever positions of authority that we have, when we take those seriously, we recognize that we have a lot more to lose than the things that come against us. And how often it's really our responses that get us into trouble, right? Our choosing, you know, whatever choices we make when we feel lonely, when we feel stressed, when we feel depressed, it's those choices and decisions that remove us from the blessing that we have, because we lack the acknowledgement and we lack the understanding that we have in the state that we operate what we need if we could just acknowledge that. If we can recognize who we are. The Israelites had what they needed to succeed. They had a God. They didn't worship another one. They had wives. They didn't need to go, you know, off, you know, with temple prostitutes. Like, they had what they needed. But from that lack of gratitude, that lack of recognition, we have what we need. We have, you know, what we're after. We have the strength to succeed. Their choices and decisions became their actual undoing. I mean, seriously, picture that. Can you look back at something in your life where your words, your mouth got you in trouble? Right? Yeah. Maybe a physical action, something you did, right? You know, like, or I can't tell you how many times, you know, I got something wrong, or I thought someone said or did something they didn't, and then I react and find out I was wrong. Now I feel like an idiot. Well, I mean, what would you have done if you were in my shoes? You know, is the only argument I can offer. Like, you know, then I'm sorry. You know, I was misinformed. I didn't know. I didn't recognize that. You know, how easily I think we are provoked and how easily we miss so often in the process that we're in and in the effort that we had, that we have mighty weapons to succeed, but it's the lack of acknowledgement of what we have. And then it's our choices in that response that positions the church, in my opinion, to operate at a level where it's not empowered. It's not doing the things that we call it to do. I saw someone post on Facebook as a comment to prayer. They were saying, if there's one thing that Facebook will remind us at the end of our lives is that, or that it will serve to remind us at the end of our lives, is that we didn't pray because we had a lack of time. And I get the point that we're making, a bit legalistic, but I get the point. Like, I understood the point that we're saying, like, we often say, well, I don't have the time, or I can't, or I won't. And it's not that we can't or we won't. We could, but we don't invest in it. And how often is our choices that exactly? We could choose patience, right? We could choose to believe what the Sermon on the Mount says. We could choose that. We can see what God could possibly do if we did what he said. But why? When impatience is so much more fun, you know? Why? You know, we can choose, you know, to focus on the things that set before us, but we're so easily provoked to remove ourselves from the blessings and the callings that we have, and then we become frustrated that we're not given more, or we're not promoted to the next thing. I can't tell you how often I have conversations with our leaders, or I've had conversations with people that have told me, they're like, man, the more God gives you, like, the more you have to protect what you have. Because you'll suddenly realize that it was okay to say the things you said once, but that's not you anymore, and you won't get away with that anymore. You know, it was okay to be involved in the things you were once, but that's not you anymore. You can't be, I mean, it's so funny. I feel bad for these politicians that the second they announce that they're running for president, right, their entire lives are under a microscope. Every action, every behavior, right? How often you hear someone being dismissed from someone's party, you know, because of a choice or decision they make, because they have to sort of separate themselves from, like, the decisions other people make, and that sort of reflecting back on them. Suddenly they're under these, like, you know, people are focusing on them so much that they have to be conscious about what they say and do. Because I can make a comment to you privately and not have to worry about it. They're on CNN and Fox for every choice or decision they make, right? And do we acknowledge that we have that same spiritual platform? That in our mouths, we have the opportunity and the ability to change our circumstance by the choices we make and by the things we choose to think and focus on. Are we removing ourselves from a victim mentality of they did, they said, this happened, and so what was I left to do? Or are we operating, and I love the language in Danny Silk's book, Keep Your Love On, that he reinforces, are we powerful people that aren't, our choices aren't dictated by outside sources? It doesn't matter what anybody's going to do. You're going to make this choice. And he focuses on doing that in the context of marriage. You know, he does these marriage seminars, and he says, every time we do a conference, we always get someone saying, but my husband does and says this. My wife does and says these things. If they didn't, then I would. And he's like, that's not the strength of the gospel. It's you choose to treat them with respect, regardless of what they're going to do, because your choices and actions come from who you are and who he is, not what anybody else is doing. And your decisions and choices aren't dictated by someone's past failures, because you're not them. It's by what God asks you to do and taking that decision and that choice seriously. Or else we find ourselves riding a donkey, standing against the very thing we're saying we're going to represent. Never. it's not even because I'm easily provoked. I just like, yeah, it's like, why does your hair look like that? Can you please get back on topic, Mr. President? Yeah, I just couldn't. What I feel a lot, yeah. I could, but I won't. I won't run for president. Well, I won't say I won't. I currently am choosing not to. This will be recorded. Maybe one day someone will hold this against me. Alberto flip-flops. He said he wouldn't. Now he's saying he will. I was avoiding naming candidates. I'm too young. You're right. Don't have to be 35? 35, yeah. Yeah, I can't. I'll run for like a position in Senate or something. You thought it was funny? I'll take 40. That's fine. This is fine. I encourage us to examine our own hearts, and I encourage us to really look at the thought mechanisms or the defense mechanisms that we often have that we use to justify our actions. And what we define, because really the struggle that we have in those choices, if we're not operating in the Spirit, if we're not operating by what we say is the biblical mandate that we say we represent and choose to live by, and that does mean things like fasting having a place in your life. He didn't just suggest it. That does mean loving your enemies, right? That's not just a suggestion. And I can tell you what, man, like, I'm gonna pick on Western Christians. We are like the biggest wussies sometimes because we couldn't handle persecution, like real persecution, because of the little things that like sets us off, right? Just like small things, like, I don't know, I don't let my kids watch TV. No mom should. Oh my God, you're talking about my kids, you know, or like whatever, or I don't like that, you know, that person running for president, or I don't like the hot button issues. They killed that gorilla. Like, I'm gonna go off on it, you know? And we're sitting there going, are you seriously being provoked by something so small in the scope of the callings and purposes that we have? You would not survive real persecution. You will not survive. You don't understand the meaning of loving your enemies. Do you understand the real power that actually exists when you serve and love your enemy, right? When you read books like Tortured for Christ by Richard Wurmbrand, here's a dude who was physically tortured for many years under Romanian communist rule and every day had to choose to love his enemies and got to see what that love did and the lives that got changed and transformed. The number of people who got saved under communist rule where Christianity was outlawed and you could be killed for preaching the gospel. The number of guards that got to hear the gospel. Even to this day, the number of Christians who stayed in Iraq to preach the gospel to the ISIS member that we would shoot at. Right? And then try to nullify their sacrifice by our own actions because we don't understand what it means to love at that capacity. I know more Christians that would respond by assaulting and attacking someone, feel more comfortable doing that than actually sharing and preaching the gospel. And talk about that in with pride. And don't get me wrong, I totally understand concealed weapons permit. I get like why we make these choices. I'm not doubting that. But I listen to people describe what they would do under certain circumstances. And I go, how do you share the gospel? Oh, I don't do that. Why are you a Christian? Like, I don't understand what we're doing here. Like, no wonder no one takes this seriously because we're not actually willing to model out the things we say we want to, right? And I'm preaching to the choir here. Like, I'm with you, right? Like, I pick on people. I get it. Like, I need to stop. Maybe not today, but I just need to stop. I'm in recovery, all right, guys? It's a process. So, no, please don't feel bad. Really, I don't need sympathy for that. So, no, I really, like, there has to be a challenge in our hearts to ask ourselves the questions, when we bought into this, did we actually say we want to live like Christ? Is that the choice that we're making? Because that road actually requires a level of self-sacrifice. And I'm not talking perfection. I'm not talking that we always get it right. But that we're actually making an intentional decision in the way we think, in the way we speak, in the way we view our circumstances, that we remove ourselves from powerless thinking. What will we do? And begin to recognize, what do I have? And how well do I live, and how much, you know, he's given me, and how faithful has he been in the end? And beginning to actually think powerfully, is this situation that overwhelming and that uncomfortable? Am I seeing this in the proper light? Have I bought into a lie that is undermining my success and has, dude, I know some people that are so great at self-sabotaging that it doesn't bother me when they say something negative about me. I'm like, I don't even need retribution. Like, you will mess up your own situation in 2 seconds. Like, I don't really, like, you, seriously, how many people do we know are so good at self-sabotaging? And it's so easy to look at them and go, you are the product of the mistakes and the problems that you have in your life. Yet when we look in the mirror, we're like, man, it's because of my boss, it's because of this person, it's because of all of these things. But in truth, we carry the ability to bless and curse and operate at a level and a scale to see our success. And if we are not careful about the choices and decisions that we make, it will fall on us and there will be no one else to take up that responsibility. Yes, sir. Yeah. To me, one of the things that I find so scary, honestly, and it's a thought that often, like, I think about, is I don't ever want to look back on my life or stand before God and look at a situation and find out that I made it harder for myself. It didn't have to be that bad. It was your nasty attitude. Like, you made it worse for yourself. That situation didn't have to work out that way. It could have been better if you just had enough faith for it and believed that it would work out, right? It is easier for us to believe negative things about ourselves than the things that God speaks over our lives. It is easier for us to believe in our ability to sin than God's ability to get glory and grace out of the lives we live. It is easier to believe and trust that we will fail and look at people who are failing than to ever believe that God has set us apart to do something mighty. And we lose that completely. There is a reason why people look at Christianity and go, why would I want that? Like, you're not living much better, and it doesn't seem like it's really taking much effect in your heart, you know? In the essence of the change that we're looking for ourselves, and we're looking for other, in looking in other people, excuse me, in other circumstances, often reside in our ability and our connection to hear and see exactly what God's saying and doing, and to be able to perceive where the heart of the conflict actually exists. It's why Paul makes statements like, we do not war against flesh and blood, but against powers and principalities. He's trying to take the focus on, get your eyes off the person and look at the mindsets and the ideals that influence that situation. And begin to purge your life from those influences so that you could move forward into the things that you're looking for. It is a captivity that we, at our scale, are not mindful that we have that disable us to operate, to the callings and purposes that God has for us. Do you guys remember that movie, The Truman Show? I saw a great video essay that I sent to a bunch of people that, like, when I saw it, I'm like, man, what a beautiful picture. There's this guy, his YouTube channel is called Nerdwriter, and I've been following him for some time, and he did this great video essay talking about The Truman Show and using The Truman Show with Jim Carrey. How many people have seen that movie again? Not the Russian. Not the Russian. What is The Truman Show? That was a terrible Russian impression. I apologize to any Russian listener. How many people haven't seen that movie? So I don't, like, say key things. Okay, you know what? I won't spoil it. So the general idea of The Truman Show is there's a person who has been living on this massive stage, right, this TV show, and does not know that he is the subject of the greatest reality show ever created. So his entire life, he is living in a world where there are hidden cameras, and he lives in this huge studio of buildings and houses, and he's, like, in this massive dome, and he has the illusion that he's free. Like, yeah, I mean, I'm just free like everybody else. I can walk around not knowing that everyone around him are just actors playing in this TV show he's in. And throughout the film, you see interviews of the creator of the show. When he's interviewed and asked, don't you think this is cruel? Don't you think what you're doing is messed up? And his response is, if Truman really wanted to be free, the signs are there that he is living in captivity, that he's a captive. But he's okay to live like this for now. And it's not until towards the end of the film that he's looking back at key things that happened in his life and he's going, there was a sign there and a sign there and a sign there and a sign there and a sign there. But I wasn't ready to accept that reality. I thought it was such a beautiful picture of really the lifestyles that we engage in and the choices that we make and our inability to recognize that we often can experience that sort of matrix, that matrix reality of thinking we're free, but we're captive to something else. And we're given the opportunity to, with the right lens, to acknowledge and recognize the greed, the pride, the arrogance, the fear, the frustration that holds us back. But the courage that it takes to remove ourselves from that requires a level of self-sacrifice and a level of selflessness that most of us think we're possessing or acting in, but we don't, right? I heard this great business economist say something that was I thought was illustrated really well the way we sort our approach, the way we think. There's what we say we're doing, there's what we think we're doing, and there's the reality of what we're doing, right? When someone says they're generous, that can look very different on a multiple different levels, right? And the level of that, the way that generosity operates and the way that generosity, you know, how much it can sting, right? Because if you have a guy who has $2 billion and he donates $1 million, and then you got a guy who has 20 bucks and gives $20, the reality of those sacrifices, as nice as it is that both gave, is going to reflect what someone understands is selfless, right? And it's that level of selflessness that is often required in our approach to whatever conflict we use as the excuse for why we are set off. In our time, we fight against the reality of whether or not racism exists in the United States and whether or not it's systemic or isn't. And then we see people's response. Is it nonviolence? Is it grace? Is it selflessness? Is it understanding? Does it have forgiveness involved in it? Does it require a level of self-sacrifice? When I actually look at the nonviolent movement that existed both in the United States and India, which required someone being physically assaulted and not fighting back in order for it to work, it required you losing your freedom for the message to be clear. Do we have that level of self-sacrifice right now in our relationships and the people we operate and work with? When we talk about the change that we want to see in the opposing worldviews that we as Christians preach and argue against, and, you know, let's pick on abortion in the United States, right? As Christians, that's a hot topic issue. You know, it's easy to say abortion is wrong and it's bad. It's a lot harder for us to choose to adopt a child. I read this report that said the growing rates of adoption in the United States is coming from, or that the largest demographic of people who are adopting is the homosexual community. And the lowest adopters are Christian conservatives. Which one argues against abortion and which one argues about choice? And it's ironic. It's just like, which one has more power? The person who's saying, I'm going to put my money where my mouth is, and I'm going to say yes to life, right? And make choices that communicate life. And what's the other side of the board saying, I have a lot of ideas and ideologies, but let none of them affect my choices and actions? The appearance of piety, but denying its power, right? And I think ultimately it should be a challenge that it does begin to change at a grassroots level. When we preach about our faith, what we're preaching is revolution. What it looks like is a people gathering and making personal changes and living in such a radical lifestyle that it seems to become a threat to the ideologies around it, right? And I'm not talking bombing abortion clinics or Molotov cocktails to opposing party members, right? What I'm talking about is living in such a radical love that you choose life at every opportunity. Derek Loix, who was a member of the IHOP team, the International House of Prayer in Kansas City, I just happened to be at this conference where he came in to talk about adoption, and I had never in my life heard someone describe it this way. And he said, I don't say no, I just kind of say yes to whatever pops up in front of me. And he goes, because when you're walking through the streets of Calcutta and you see these little girls that are being prostituted at 8, 9, 10 years old, your no, out of fear of being inconvenienced, takes on a new light. And he goes, and the challenge of what your yes could do for someone, right? And here's a lesson. I obviously have not adopted any children. Like, so, but here's a power behind that. He's like, what happened was I began to say yes and yes and yes and yes and yes. And now I have 12 children. He's like, and not only did I have 12 children, but suddenly the recognition of I have to be responsible for these kids made me and my wife begin to pray about how we do this on a larger scale. So we created an organization that adopts kids, and now we have 120 kids. How powerful is that, right? Grassroots. It started with one decision that was going to affect my life that I had to say yes to. And it progressed from there until now we have a full-scale organization where we need support from all these other organizations and donors and people who support us, but we get to be more effective in what we do. Whatever dream, whatever calling, whatever thing that is ours starts at that, recognizing it's a revolution reaction to, I almost said Revolution Reality too, I'm so, got so mad. That's my buddy's organization. And I'm just like, every time I'm talking, I'm like, do not say Revolution Reality. It is a reality about revolution. but it is a recognition of how serious we have to take the thing that we represent and how serious we have to ask ourselves, do we believe what we believe? Because I don't fear a radical extremist. I fear a passive complacent. Like, that fool will let anything happen. Martin Luther King had this great quote where he says, when we look back on the trials that we went through, we will not remember what our enemy says, but the lack of responses that our friends had. When you finally make it through to the other end and you look at the people, the thing that hurt the most is not your opposers, you expected that from them, were those you thought would be your greatest supporters. So to me, when we preach community, when we preach church, it takes on a radical acknowledgement of what choices and decisions we are responsible for. And I, for one, recognize that there are many times where I did not take those choices and those decisions very seriously, right? This year, I struggled heavily with tithing. I'm not gonna lie. Alicia and I's finances, especially because of the company that we started, is always so up and down that I allowed the fear to creep into my heart. And I was always worried about, like, what about the next bill? What about the next bill? What about the next bill? And that fear eliminated my generosity. So I didn't begin to operate in the power and calling of God to say, give and I will give more to you. I didn't know what the hell that meant because what I feared is hoard and fear tomorrow, you know? And so that fear, that recognition tied me up from being able to experience God operate on that scale. And what blew me away was when, and I'm going to put this person on the spot. I walked into my office, and we have those like little envelopes in the back where you put your money in and you write down what it's for. And I literally was drinking something, and I happened to look down, and I see Allison's name on this piece of paper. And it says, my money for my prom dress, it's everything I have. Yeah, and I sat there and I'm going, someone actually gave everything they had and may never experience, you know, maybe getting the dress that they wanted, but to them, there was a choice to support something that was bigger than them. A reality that I'm not modeling or recognize or am acknowledging or recognizing. And they're like, you know, the conviction, like you're suddenly like, oh God, I'm gonna sit. Like, I'm just gonna sit for a little bit. I'm gonna lay here and stare at the ceiling. So, you know, that reality, I heard this great story about a Mennonite church that I think it was Charles Wagner was leading. And when the Mennonite community, like when those dudes like talk about community, there are a lot of times where I look at other churches and I'm like, we got community. But then I look at Mennonite communities and I'm like, they got it. I'm like, we don't even like. These guys, I mean, they agree to the lives that they're going to live and they hold each other accountable, right? So when they agree to tithe to the church, if you are suspected of not tithing, then you have people who will audit your books and see your income and your going because they're going to say, all right, you know. And not in a mean way, they're going, hey, man, we all agreed to this, right? And so we have to live open, and we have to live honestly. And I made the same agreement you made, so if you're struggling, let me know. But we agreed to this process, so let's stick to it, right? And there was a great testimony that I heard about where, again, integrity is huge in the Mennonite community because integrity for your family means something. Integrity for the church, your integrity in your family will be reflected in the way you operate in the church. And there were these two Mennonite families where one of them sold a house to someone else, and there were tons of issues that they claimed the house did not have. And one of those issues was the septic system was broken, and the repair cost was $12,000. And so when one of the members of the congregation found out, they showed up to that person and said, hey, you know, how's your house? I heard you purchased this property. And they said, yeah, you know, we're going to work on it. But unfortunately, there were lots of things that we were told, you know, we were going to do or that were repaired that weren't. And when he found out, yeah, like the septic system is $12,000. And he goes, who sold you the house? And he goes, so-and-so. And he says, yeah, he goes to my church. And he goes, okay. So the guy pulls out his pocket and writes a check for $4,000. And he goes, here's the first, you know, third, and I'll talk to our leaders and we'll come up with the rest of it. Because in their minds, that mistake was our mistake. And the integrity of that decision reflected on the community. And so his reaction was, I need to physically do something about this, and I'm going to get other people involved in this process. So imagine when you're in that community and someone gives you their word, what that means. Versus when someone else says something and you're like, eh, it could happen and it might not. Because in the culture that we live in, someone's word doesn't carry the same level of weight. I am like totally ranting right now. So again, I think the challenge for us is to ask ourselves, what are we truly living? What are we truly seeing? Are we acknowledging the blessings and the callings that we have? Are we recognizing the responsibility that we have on both a social level, on a cultural level, that we actually have the power to change our communities and change the way people and see and do things by putting our foot down in our own personal actions and taking a level of responsibility that we are empowered in the gospel as we read the word, taking that level of responsibility and that faith to say, if he said he'll do it, I just need to move forward. Or are we like the way Balaam operated at the end, selling out in our inactions or in our actual actions out of greed or selfishness? Because either our story are encouraging people, our lifestyles are encouraging people closer to God, right? Or it's going to naturally affect people to either move towards him or move further away. And I know that we did not choose to become Christians, and we did not choose to follow a God of selflessness, not recognizing that that has a cost. And that believing in that liberation starts at sacrificing and making that choice, whatever that means for you guys. So if I could just pray for you guys real quick. We are having a game night at my house, quick switch of gears. So if you guys want to come over and hang out, feel free to come over and hang out. I don't care if you're a stranger or if I know you. If I know you, don't come. If you're a stranger, come. So I just want to pray for you guys real quick. Heavenly Father, we first and foremost, we repent for whatever choices and decisions we have been making that do not reflect the promises that you have called us to. And so we set those things on the cross, and we acknowledge and recognize whatever that thing is. If you guys would just think about whatever that thing is that you just need to repent for and just put it in your hand, just ball up your hand and pretend it's in your hand. Lord God, we place these things before us. We place these things in our hands and recognizing what those things are. And we open our palms to you and we ask you, Jesus, to take it. We acknowledge the sacrifice of your son for those choices and those decisions and recognize that there is no guilt and there is no shame, for you have set us free. And Lord, walking in the power of your blood, we cast those things aside and we recognize that you don't remember them and we're not going to remember them anymore. And we ask you, Holy Spirit, to enlighten our eyes and to enlighten our hearts to the truth, that you would again illuminate our hearts and that we would not walk in the fear of what we will see, but that we will walk in encouragement for the liberation that stands before us. And may your gospel, may your word, may your testimonies, may your might be placed again at the throne of our hearts, that our lives today are changed forever. In Jesus' name, amen.